Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, we are reviewing the best documentaries of the year. There were so many beautifully shot films raising important questions and peering into the lives of ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Joining me to talk about the best documentaries of the year are two guests. Michael Fox is a longtime San Francisco film critic and journalist. He currently writes for KQED Arts, the East Bay Monthly, Oakland Magazine, among others. He teaches documentary classes at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at UC Berkeley and SF State, and he curates and hosts the Cinema Lit film series at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco. And Michael Fox has been writing about film since 1987, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Michael. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be here, Rose.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Dan Geller. With his wife, Dana Goldfein, Dan has made documentaries for over 25 years. Together as directors and producers, they have created Emmy Award-winning, critically acclaimed documentaries. In 2014, Dan was admitted to the documentary branch of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And Dan also joins me in studio. Hi, Dan. Welcome
Hello.
To the show.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you. So, I love this show because we've done so many shows about documentaries focusing on the Black Panther Party, Recyclers in West Oakland. 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets was about Jordan Davis, a black teenager playing loud music in Jacksonville, Florida, in a gas station parking lot. And just so many great ones. Dan, when you look back at the year, what stands out for you?
It's an extraordinary year, I think. The past several years have seen so many really good documentaries, but this year I think there are so many that when it came time as an Academy member and the documentary branch were supposed to come up with 15 for the short list, and I looked at the list and thought, I have to leave films off the 15 cutoff that easily could have been part of that cutoff of 15. And I don't know if that has been the case in the past where we've had 20, maybe 25 films that are so strong aesthetically, conceptually, in some cases politically. The films that are out this year that are, to my mind, that come to the forefront span everything from the political to the aesthetic, music to politics to looks at parts of life that have no flashlight on them otherwise. And I think of films like Laurie Anderson's Heart of a Dog, which to some might not even seem like a documentary. It's a meditation. It's a poem about loss and love and animals and childhood and Lou Reed. A beautiful movie. And I contrast that with a film like The Look of Silence, a devastating portrait looking at a family that lost a son in the 1965 Indonesian genocide. It's a companion piece to Joshua Oppenheimer's first film about the genocide called The Act of Killing. There's a film like Amy, which is completely archival material, and he's made a beautiful film before that called Senna, stylistically. Not a shred of original material, but a beautiful assemblage of voiceover and archival footage. Just absolutely brilliant.
About Amy Winehouse.
About Amy Winehouse, right. Yes. There's a serial comic film called Finders Keepers about a man who lost his leg in a light airplane accident and in the Deep South and wound up losing his leg but wanting to keep the leg as a memento. And then he ran into some financial trouble and other issues, and his leg wound up in a barbecue smoker that he put into storage. And then when another man in the South bought the storage shed, claimed the leg and wanted to keep the leg as a tourist attraction, and then they got into a legal battle. And it's hilariously funny, but also a sad portrait at the same time. I could go on and on. There's so many amazing films this year.
Why do you think that we're getting so many good films? What has really changed? Because I feel like there's just such a great array. You can't even keep up. And you said that you've seen so many more and more better films over the last 3 years. What explains that?
Yeah, I think it's a confluence of things that have been coming together over the course of several years. One is that there are many more ways to exhibit a film out now than there used to be, whether it's on Netflix or Amazon, HBO Go, all these other ways of watching a movie other than a scheduled appointment through a broadcaster. That's opened up the doors somewhat to funding and acquisition, but certainly to reaching an audience. I think Kickstarter and those kinds of funding campaigns have allowed filmmakers to gather the resources that otherwise would have come from a few grants, maybe, or a broadcast commission, maybe. I think the tools of the trade have changed. So we have these beautiful, beautiful cameras that cost a fraction of what they used to. So the aesthetics of the image have improved radically as well. I think you begin to pull all these things together, they begin to feed on themselves, so that as more filmmakers make more beautiful films and films that may not be quite as readily slotted into what was expected in terms of a documentary subject or style, it leads other filmmakers to follow suit.
And Michael, before you talk about what stood out for you this year, you have been reviewing films since 1987. How do you explain the changes that we've been seeing over the past few years?
Well, I'd say some positives and some negatives. The negatives, of course, would be the disappearance of investigative journalism by network news teams. Mm-hmm. So documentary filmmakers have stepped into that gap, and audiences are famished for those kind of in-depth reports or on-location films. And independent filmmakers do that kind of work, and we can't get that anywhere else. So we'll go to the Sudan for We Come As Friends, or we'll go to China with the Iron Ministry, for example. And it's a place we're not going to go to on our own, and the filmmaker gives us a view of that society, of that culture, whether it's a social issue film or not. And no one from NBC is going to do that anymore. So that's the negative that's turned into a positive for filmmakers, I think. The other element is that we've transitioned from, let's say, educational films, that is what we saw in high school, where the emphasis was on information. That was the filmmaker's goal, was to impart information, to more of a narrative emphasis, which perhaps leads to entertainment at the far side. But there's some balance. There's some balance between information and entertainment.
Hopefully, yes.
Hopefully. And increasingly, when you ask documentary filmmakers, and I don't know if Dan would say this, they call themselves storytellers more than anything. To quote David Thompson, our local critic and historian and essayist, he thinks of documentary as just another genre of filmmaking now that happens to use non-professional actors. So that might be somewhat of a cynical view, but that's how people consume documentaries, let's say. That's how the audience sees it, just another kind of film.
I wouldn't say it's cynical, and I think it's actually largely accurate. One of the bugaboos I have, people tend to categorize movies as narrative and documentary. And whenever that happens, I get obnoxious about it, and I'll stop the conversation and say, no, when you go to a bookstore, does it say narrative and documentary? It says fiction and nonfiction. And I think that David's right in that a good story is a good story, whether it's told in a fictive format or a nonfiction format. I think about the good nonfiction writers, whether it's Malcolm Gladwell or David McCulloch, who these are page turners, or Caro. They're incredible books. So I do believe that it's not bad medicine anymore the way it used to be, you know, these informational pieces. And they're not necessarily reportage because, as you mentioned before, some of these investigative reports are not aiming to be objective particularly, or give equal weight to equal sides, or unequal sides, I should say. So, but the lines get a little blurry. I mean, they always have. There's never been anything such as objective journalism. It's just a canard. But the lines do get blurred up a bit in terms of fiction and nonfiction when you're looking at a documentary. And sometimes the line is very hard to demarcate. And so it requires a more active viewer, in my opinion, to suss out what really is going on in the movie. And in a fiction film, we were just talking about a few moments before coming on air, The Lady in the Van, which is a wonderful film. It opens up with a title card that says, what you're about to see is mostly true.
Well, and so, Michael, what stood out for you this year? You mentioned a few.
Well, I would cite Listen to Me, Marlon, which is one of many artist profiles, along with Amy, along with the Janis Joplin film that came out this year. And what's special about that film for me is what he does with the form of documentary. The starting point were these audio tapes that Brando recorded for himself over a long period of time. And now the filmmaker has to figure out how to illustrate this, because we're talking motion pictures. And so there's a conventional way to do it, or a simple chronology. And he does something more complex and sophisticated and much richer. And I'm really drawn to films like that and Heart of a Dog, the Laurie Anderson film that Dan mentioned, that push the form, that stretch our definition of documentary or nonfiction. Mm-hmm. If you, they really, nonfiction's a much better umbrella, really, for all these kind of films.
And what I spoke to the filmmaker who made Listen to Me, Marlon, and among the things they found, that Marlon Brando had scanned his head with one of these early three-dimensional studios that could do a scan of his head. So, and then they animated that. They texture mapped the face to another actor reading the words that Marlon had been speaking in an audio tape only, but left it in a somewhat primitive visual form. And it feels like a ghost, an apparition, something speaking from the other side in a fever dream. It's brilliant that way.
Dan Geller with his wife, Dana Goldfein, have made documentaries for over 25 years. As directors and producers, they've created Emmy Award-winning documentaries. Michael Fox is a longtime San Francisco film critic and journalist. He writes for KQED Arts, the East Bay Monthly, and Oakland Magazine. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the best documentaries of the year. We'd love to hear from you. What stands out for you? What really inspired you to act? What do you think makes for a really great documentary? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We already have a number of emails coming in. Sheila writes, documentaries are the best. I'm so glad I have lived long enough to see the blossoming of documentary films. This year, my three favorites have been Peggy Guggenheim, Art Addict, about whom I knew nothing but could not resist the call of art around her, the Black Panther Party, and Amy, the one that you just mentioned. I thought I knew so much about the party, but learned more and the truth about just how awful this government of ours has been towards any peoples who they believed were a threat to its so-called democracy. And we did a show about that documentary. Mm-hmm. Have you seen it?
Yes, yes. And it's amazing, the richness of historical material that Stanley Nelson unearthed, and also how there are present-day analogs to what that film is talking about. If you watch it critically, you understand that an awful lot of the troubles that we're going through in this country and the ridiculous rhetoric we're hearing, there's an antecedent there in the way that people are reacting to the Black Panther Party.
What are your thoughts about taking on a topic that has been written about and there are so many films about? For example, Stanley Nelson was on our show and I asked him about this, and he just felt like with all the films out there about activism, about the Black Panthers, about the 60s and the 70s, he just felt like they didn't go as deep as he wanted, and that's why he tackled it.
I think that if you have a unique perspective, or in the case of an historical documentary, are able to tap into a vein of resources, whether there are contemporaries of the time who can speak now, or visual material that was locked away somewhere, it can reopen an examination and a discussion. Sure. I don't think it'd be hard to find a subject that's so tapped out that it would not be interesting to make another movie about.
I'll take more of a political stance, which is that, for me, I don't know if I can be political on the air.
Of course you can.
That the 60s have been, there's been a historical revisionism that has been actively pursued by those on the right for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so films, I see certain films as counteracting that simply by unearthing history. And I'm thinking of Freedom on My Mind, about Freedom Summer. I'm thinking about The Weather Underground, Sam Green's great documentary.
Wonderful film.
And Stanley's film. And we could quibble about Stanley's film because, as he admits, there's so many stories that he could tell, and he focused on a handful. But just by taking us back in time, or the Muhammad Ali film from a year or two ago, just taking us back to a point in time and hearing people speak at that moment or seeing what happened at that moment cuts through whatever has been mythologized or invented about that period.
We have another recommendation from Judy. A good made-on-a-budget documentary that I've seen a number of times is The Healthcare Movie. It tells how Canada won its national healthcare system and why Canadians now wouldn't have it any other way. It points the way to what the U.S. could have if we eliminated private, for-profit health insurance, top-quality healthcare for all for far less money. the group Single Payer Now can show the movie to you if you have a group to get together and then also answer questions. You can order the movie at healthcaremovie.net.
It reminds me of another movie that in some ways has a lot to do with Canada and Vancouver, which is How to Change the World, which, apropos of what Michael's talking about, it's about the founding of Greenpeace, the early years of Greenpeace, mm-hmm. with unbelievable footage. They were documenting themselves all the way through. And there's a parallel story of the energy and optimism of a group that comes together, a group of fighters, really. And then what happens over time as the personalities clash and the whole thing begins to fall apart. But a fabulous movie that's out this year.
And I should say, so many of the films that we're mentioning today, thanks to producer Laura Flynn, the trailers are at yourcallradio.org. So I know that hopefully a lot of us have time off over the holidays. It'd be great to watch some of these films. Thank you for that email. Chris in Oakland, what do you think about Vice News? And they're doing so many amazing short documentaries in some cases.
Fantastic. I think they are increasingly becoming a real investigative journalism powerhouse and outside the normal system. I think it's absolutely terrific and a real surprise to see a whole unit of people coming together to consistently put out new work.
And what's the name of the outfit that Laura Poitras and A.J. Schnack have founded under the auspices of The Intercept?
Right. I forget the name of it. I don't recall.
I don't remember. Laura was on talking about the Edward Snowden documentary, but she hasn't come out with anything yet, right? I think she's working on...
These are short documentaries that they not only are making but are producing, so they're soliciting and supporting other filmmakers.
Okay. And then in the same vein, I want to give a shout-out to Frontline because mm-hmm. they have had some great films this year. Rape on the Night Shift, about women who are janitors who are being sexually harassed and raped. And thanks to this documentary and the amazing lawyers and the women that have come forward, a lawsuit was just settled. Mm-hmm. And one woman who sued her corporation won her case. And so films like this actually create major, major change.
They have the potential of doing that, definitely.
Yeah. Another one, kind of in the same vein, The Hunting Ground.
Yes.
We did a show about that. It's about rape on college campuses. What's interesting is The Hunting Ground was shown on CNN. And like Blackfish was shown on CNN about SeaWorld. And once CNN picks it up, then it just gets mass distribution.
Yeah, many of the broadcasters have gone this route. And HBO certainly was a leader in commissioning independent, interesting documentaries. ESPN has done that with more sports-themed, but some political edge to them. Definitely CNN is in that game. Netflix is commissioning original work. That cuts both ways. They don't maintain a unit to make these long-form documentaries. But the flip side of it is that they, I suspect, are much more free to pick up a range of filmmakers and points of view. But yes, once they rally behind these movies, and often they are trying to put them into movie theaters for at least a small run, because if they get into movie theaters, typically, for better or for worse, there is a review. It elevates the visibility of the movie and also presumably brings some prestige to the organization itself.
And Laura Poitras's company is Praxis Films. You can see it online. It looks like there's a couple different films up there, shorts.
Or at The Intercept, which is the website that Glenn Greenwald and she founded with some other folks, too.
Right.
And then the Center for Investigative Reporting based here, which is a terrific organization, raising funds and making sure that there's at least some deep investigative reporting going on.
Just to build on the points that we've all been making, which is that we think in terms of theatrical documentaries, and that's what the Oscar goes to, and that's kind of where this conversation began. The reality is that most people will see documentaries on television or Netflix now mm-hmm. or the Internet now.
Right.
That's where things are going, which, if I can make another point about this, which also may have an influence on the length of documentaries. In other words, people watching online may want shorter films. And not every subject warrants 90 minutes or 60 minutes. So this may be another trend to keep an eye on.
I think in both directions, that also a film could be longer than a 60-minute slot or an 88, 56, whatever the number is. You know, that's such a straitjacket in terms of the pace, the rhythm, the sensibility of the movie, that it can be as long or as short as it needs to be.
Well, thank you for the email, Chris. Today we are talking about documentaries, the best documentaries of the year, with Dan Geller, a filmmaker, and Michael Fox, longtime San Francisco film critic. You can join us at 866-798-8255. What stood out for you? What do you like about documentaries? What makes a great documentary? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Melody in Oakland. Hi, Melody. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to mention the documentary I saw at the Shattuck Theater in downtown Berkeley called Rosenwald. It was educational and informative about a Jewish man who owned Sears, who was a philanthropist, and he saw the lack of education and discrimination by black children in the South, and he built 5,000 schools. He supported the arts, many black writers, etc. He built a garden-like affordable housing units. So why I bring this up is I think philanthropy and giving back to our community is something that's really lacking, and it was really uplifting for me because I felt kind of jaded about this situation where it seems like everybody's out to get as much money as they can. And the issue I want to bring up is the Shattuck Theater is under attack to be replaced by a 24-story building, luxury apartments, and it's being fought. But I think the Shattuck is a great resource, and that film was really inspirational. I'd never heard of this man, so that's what I had to say.
I'm from Chicago, and I'd never heard of Julius Rosenwald, I'm embarrassed to say. I'd heard of Sears, certainly.
Yeah, so it was really interesting to have that presented, and I told many of my friends to go see the film, and they all really liked it as well.
I appreciate your point, because I think in some ways the intent of the film was to hearken to a period when black-Jewish relations were very different than perhaps they are post-60s. Mm-hmm. But I think you make a great point that philanthropists of another age had more of a sense of community and not taking credit and letting other people help themselves. Because these schools that were built, the schools had to raise half the money.
Yes.
He
mm-hmm.
gave half the money, and then the communities had to raise half the money. And it was a brilliant model.
And they wanted to build their own schools and hire their own workers so they would have jobs.
Hmm. Well,
so thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Melody, because I heard about that film, and now your review makes me want to see it. And you make such a good point also about theaters.
Yes.
Because so many of us watch online, but we should go support our local theater.
I think it's hugely important. And some films particularly are so much more enjoyable, impactful, seen on a huge screen with great sound.
Right.
It's a hard go for theaters. I think a lot of them are getting a little bit smarter about what makes the experience worthwhile going out to, in addition to just the screen. It might be being able to have a drink in the theater or have some food. The new Mission Theater, which is opening in San Francisco tonight, I think, or tomorrow night.
Alamo?
It's Alamo Draft House, right. But it's actually keeping the marquee from the original theater, which is called the new Mission. And they'll have food in there. And you could argue one way or the other whether that's going to be a distraction. But anything, I believe, to get people out and into that theater is useful because it's expensive and babysitters and so forth. And people have really nice screens at home these days. But there is something also about the communal experience about sitting there, especially if the film has an emotional wallop or is funny. It elevates the entire experience, I think. And certainly as a filmmaker, I vastly prefer to have people go to a theater if possible.
Yes, support your local theater. Today we are talking about our favorite documentaries of the year. Dan Geller is a documentary filmmaker. Michael Fox is a longtime San Francisco film critic. And we'd love to hear from you. What stood out for you this year? What makes a great documentary? And what inspires you to act? You can give us a call, 866-798-8255, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard on today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, you're welcome to join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question on the show's website, yourcallradio.org. As the end of 2015 approaches, we hope you will keep KALW in mind when you consider your year-end charitable contributions. When you donate to KALW, you're giving great non-commercial radio to people all around the Bay Area. Make your contribution anytime at KALW.org, and best wishes to you for the holiday season from all of us here at KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be talking about the consequences of anti-abortion rhetoric and legislation. For weeks, we heard about those heavily edited videos in the news of Planned Parenthood. And then when the organization was cleared of any wrongdoing, there was very little media coverage, and the anti-choice rhetoric continued. So we're going to talk about how the laws and the rhetoric are affecting the safety of providers and patients. That's tomorrow, Friday. It's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, if you'd like to talk about a documentary that stood out for you, what makes a great documentary, what inspired you to act, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Michael Fox, a longtime San Francisco film critic and journalist. He's been reviewing films since 1987. And Dan Geller and his wife, Dana Goldfein, have made documentaries for over 25 years. And I just learned that Dan and Dana, you're on the committee to choose the best documentary for the Oscars?
There are branches inside the Academy that are specific to the kind of work that one does, and the documentary branch is one of them. So, we wind up any documentary that qualifies, and what qualifies a documentary for theaters, that is, varies year to year as the rules shift around a bit. But we really get to see just about everything if we want to, and are assigned a certain percentage randomly within the branch. And then that's how ballots are cast to make a short list, and from that, the nominations. Then with every branch at that point, when there's a nomination announced, which I believe is next month sometime, then everybody in the entire Academy will vote on all of the nominees across all of the different branches, which yields definitely results that sometimes leave you scratching your head, because how am I? I'll just make it personal. I'm not an expert on costume design, but I'm not obligated to vote in every category, and I can tell you that's one I probably won't vote in.
But you're very well dressed today.
for radio.
Just for our listeners, the number of feature-length docs that qualified for that Oscar this year was 124. Is that correct?
I think approximately, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they really have to whittle this down.
Yes, and it's almost impossible, because there are an awful lot of very good movies, and to get onto the short list is, I think, some combination of real achievement in filmmaking, but also just the luck of the draw in terms of how the ballots are cast, because you could easily come up with a different combination of 15 movies.
Well, I still remember when one of my favorite films, The Cove, won the Oscar in 2009, which was actually kind of a surprise. Mm-hmm. It's about the slaughter of dolphins in the Cove in Taiji, Japan. And the filmmaker Luis Cihoyas is out with a new film called Racing Extinction. It came out this year. I haven't seen it yet, but it's about species extinction. And what's really cool about this film is he has been able to project images of beautiful animals onto, like, the I think even the Statue of Liberty in New York.
The United Nations building.
The UN building.
Yep.
A cathedral in Italy. And he was in Paris. And so he's just been doing some amazing things to raise awareness about species extinction.
It's a beautiful film.
You've seen it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So again, that's Racing Extinction. Hopefully that might get a nomination. Well, let's go back to callers. We've got a number of callers on the – let's go to our next caller, KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rose. I appreciate it. I just have to say, the width of the historical footage of Rosenwald and the visual structure were quite exceptional to me. I'd like to nominate, it's kind of a weird thing if you're talking about documentaries, but anyway, 99 Homes. It's like a narrative documentary to me. So the documentarian perspective, the overwhelming truth of it, and the way this ethnic American, I'm sorry, I don't know his name, who wrote and directed it, was able to see through dominant people in our culture and make the film in the way he did. It was just, oh my gosh, it was like thrilling and scary, and it reminded me of Crash. It was just fantastic.
Well, thank you for that. I understand. I'm just learning. So that was a film, not a documentary. Is that right?
We're all films.
Well, okay. Sorry.
I got you.
You got me.
No, it's a work of fiction. It's a work of fiction. But maybe we want to put it under contemporary neorealism, where the emotions are so close to the surface and the situation is, as they say, ripped from today's headlines or post-crash headlines.
And it's an incredible achievement of a movie, too. I mean, the director was the writer, was also the editor. It's a very, very strong movie and a powerful indictment of the subprime mortgage disaster. It's a difficult movie to watch because it's so hard, but it's terrific. There are unbelievably good performances in it. I'm hoping that it stays afloat a bit. And I would say the companion piece as far as a fiction film goes would be The Big Short, which I thought was fantastic. Mm. And again, based on a real set of stories. It's about the subprime crash and on Michael Lewis's book. And this is where it gets a little hazy in interesting ways,
right?
That the documentary versus what would be typically all a fiction film, there's a gray area where they begin to overlap. And I think in this case, the adaptation of Michael Lewis's book was brilliant and probably best done as a fiction film rather than a straight up documentary.
There might be 6 or 8 Hollywood films this season that are based on true stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about the appeal of documentary, it may also be partly attributed to the fact that people want something that's not Hollywoodized.
Yes.
They want the original story, or they want something that's more rigorous or less manipulative.
Or another thing I would say, because Spotlight falls into that category, another terrific film. And I think the commonality in the fiction and nonfiction realms, they're character-based. The ones that are character-based, where you root for someone, where you feel the story, as in literature, as in film, same primary dynamic. They reach into the gut. They get to your mind through the gut. They're tremendous experiences. Entertaining sometimes, yes, but also in the case of 99 Homes, it's not an entertaining movie, but it is a powerfully emotional movie.
I was going to ask you both about that, because Netflix and Showtime do amazing work on this issue. So, for example, Narcos.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was addicted to this thing. It's a Netflix drama series. It's about the real life story of Pablo Escobar, the Colombian drug lord, cocaine drug lord. At one point, this guy and his team were bringing in $400 million a day. Now, this gave me nightmares because it was so incredibly violent, but mm-hmm. I couldn't stop watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched a documentary about Pablo Escobar and learned that Narcos was completely true to form.
Yes.
The documentary and Narcos were almost very similar.
Or the movie that's out this year, Cartel Land, that is one of our 2015 documentaries, a very strong movie where a young filmmaker who I met him and said, there's no way Dana and I would even dare to put ourselves at risk this way. We're just too cowardly. But he went down south of the border and really immersed himself in ways that I yield footage that is so dramatic, and it's incredibly well shot. It feels like a fiction film. It feels like something that was created out of the best of what Hollywood could do. But it's real. Every bit of it is real as a documentary. Completely gripping.
Do any other films or shows, series stand out for you? Another one that I just finished was The Tudors, about Henry VIII and his 6 wives. This was like a 4-season show on Showtime. And again, it inspired me to watch documentaries about Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn and Catherine of Aragon. So, I mean, there's so much exciting stuff out there.
I feel
it's
like
really good
really,
quality.
It's one thing to blur the boundaries of fiction and nonfiction. And when filmmakers do it, it can be a really provocative and challenging and stimulating endeavor. I fear when we talk about it in a certain way, we devalue the truth or the reality for viewers. So this lady who called in and touted 99 Homes, which is a great film, but we shouldn't mistake that for a documentary.
Yes.
And that said, let me add one more thing, which is even documentarians take liberties, not with the facts, but they shape their material to tell a satisfying story.
Years ago, I was up at Sundance for the film festival, and there was a panel session between Frederick Wiseman and Werner Herzog. And it was fantastic because Frederick Wiseman was saying that his style of long takes, very observational, and his view in many ways dispassionate, is objective. And Werner, who's always a provocateur, Werner said, "That's nonsense, Frederick. The moment you decide to hit the button to turn the camera on and hit it off again, you've made a subjective judgment. So don't tell me that you're making objective films." So to your point, Michael, yes, I think the best of intentions will create a movie, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that is as true to a moment as possible. And that's really in the hands of the filmmaker at that point, about how honest they're going to be and what their intentions are really going to be. And I know during the break, Rose, you mentioned Michael Moore's movie. Mm. And you know, I have very mixed feelings about Michael Moore's movies in general. But what's interesting in the case of this new movie, Where to Invade Next, is it's the first movie I've seen of his where basically he's shifted his point of view entirely. Instead of making a movie that's solely an attack, he went looking for something that's beautiful to try to bring to viewers. And I thought, well, that's a different essence of a filmmaker at work.
So Where to Invade Next, Michael Moore goes to other countries to steal their good ideas and bring them back to the United States. So, for example, he goes to Italy to a Ducati factory and finds that people are treated very well. They get good vacation. They have good lunches. And then he says, we need to bring that back to the U.S. And there's so many great examples about prisons, about guns, schools, women, for example. Now, of course, he cherry picks the best thing right in the country, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, he's certainly he's an entertainer, no doubt, and a character in his own movies in a big way. And what I did admire about the movie, it's a little bit simplistic, but what I did admire about the movie ultimately is that he comes to say, you know, where did all these countries get these wonderful ideas? And the answer is from us, from the era of Roosevelt, primarily, when we had some progressive notions.
Right, and it's very funny too. Of course.
And it is funny, of course. Yes.
Today we are talking about the best documentaries of the year. We'd love to hear from you. What stood out for you this year? What makes a great documentary? If you're a filmmaker, we'd love to hear from you. We're joined by Dan Geller, who is a documentary filmmaker. Michael Fox is a longtime San Francisco film critic and journalist. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Natasha writes, I watched trailers for a few documentaries this morning, and they all look great. Do your guests have thoughts on these? The Pearl Button, The Messenger, Ingrid Bergman in Her Own Words, and Hitchcock.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Hitchcock film's fabulous. I mean, it's so interesting to hear their conversations. These are the original recordings of Francois Truffaut talking with Alfred Hitchcock in the 1960s and through a translator because Hitchcock didn't speak French. But they also had found a trove of still imagery, photos, hundreds of them that were taken during the recording sessions. And it's just an incredible look at the meeting of two minds, really delving into Hitchcock and his psychology. A lot of it you could read in the fantastic book that's been reissued recently, Hitchcock Truffaut. But it's a real interesting primer about psychology, about filmmaking, about film history. The Bergman one, I loved it because there's so much to learn about her that I didn't know. And again, another sweep through film history that I enjoyed immensely. I thought they were both very good films.
What I'll say about the Hitchcock-Truffaut film is we have to remember that in the early 60s, Hitchcock was not much respected in the United States and was just seen as a genre filmmaker. The French had discovered him as an artist. And now, of course, he's widely recognized as an artist in this country. So his openness, his respect for Truffaut's questions is palpable because someone is treating him seriously as an artist. I think the trick that Kent Jones, the filmmaker, had to pull off, who's also a critic and a programmer himself, is on the one hand, film buffs know these Hitchcock films inside and out, and there's stuff to discover and learn for them. And yet, let's say the average person under 30 maybe has seen four Hitchcock movies and doesn't really they know his name. Everyone knows his name. They don't quite know what he did or why he's so important. So it serves as a primer for them as well. So it really manages to bridge every audience.
Maybe some thought he was in the Beatles or something like that.
Well, thank you for those documentary suggestions, Natasha. Actually, we have an email about Hitchcock. It put into context Hitch's comments about actors being cattle.
Yeah.
You'll have to see the film.
You'll have to see the film.
Okay.
But that was a quote in the book, in the transcribed interviews, that people sort of cherry-picked to distill or simplify or oversimplify Hitchcock's approach to filmmaking.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Carl. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking the call. Your guests might be able to correct me. I may not be the best person calling in. I think I'm a year late. The film Kill the Messenger about Gary Webb.
Right.
Which was also a narrative film,
yeah,
or a fiction film.
Film. But then when I was calling in, I was going, boy, I'm not calling with a 2015 film.
No, that's fine.
But no one saw that movie in 2014, so it's great to bring it up, and perhaps people can rediscover it now.
We did a show about that film.
Uh-huh.
Really good film.
So I'm right that I am a year late. This is a great, great film.
No, but no problem. It tells the real-life story of Gary Webb, the San Jose Mercury news reporter who broke the story that alleged that the CIA was aware of dealers who were smuggling cocaine into Los Angeles.
Yes. Very good.
Very good.
Yep.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthann. We'll add that one to our list. Chris writes in, I like the new short docs that Al Jazeera Plus has been posting on Facebook. They take news and present it with a provocative editorial twist. Yeah, I love these short. They're like 3 minutes, and they say so much in 3 minutes.
I've been so busy with looking at all these feature docs I haven't, and also some Academy-nominated or shortlisted short documentaries. I haven't had a chance to look, but Al Jazeera over the past decade has consistently, I think, put out really interesting reports about what's going on in the world in ways that we just have no clue about through the normal news organizations that we see in the States.
One that Al Jazeera did that's years old, maybe a couple of years old, was about the women in Bangladesh and men who were killed in the fire, the building that collapsed when they made clothing for Western companies. And they made a whole documentary about that. I think it's called Made in Bangladesh. Amazing film. There's a new one out that I've been meaning to see called The True Cost. And it's a film exploring the impact of fashion on people and the planet. So I'm really glad that this is getting more attention.
Good.
You kind of need 2 hours to really explore these issues.
I think so, to settle into them in a way that, again, I feel if you pull people into the story of characters, for want of a better word, and get them to feel someone's plight, I think it can mobilize someone to action in a way that perhaps a more conventional reportage would have a harder time doing. And I think that's why when you're talking about the films like The Cove, seeing that footage, but not having it told to you, but feeling what it's like to be on those boats. And I think that the call to action through feeling is typically much more urgent.
Chris also says he saw a new documentary at the Roxy last week, another great theater to support in San Francisco, Bikes versus Cars, by a Swedish director. Surprisingly good. Great coverage of the 400-kilometer establishment of dedicated bike lanes all over Sao Paulo, Brazil. That sounds great. He says he loved Edward Bertinsky's Watermark.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful movie. That was a year ago, I believe.
And also breaking the 60 to 90-minute limit is the work of Adam Curtis, mostly on the BBC. Particularly recommend his earlier work, 4 Hours, 4 Parts, The Century of Self.
Yes, he's a strong polemical filmmaker, but in some ways he's similar to Werner Herzog or Michael Moore in that he inserts himself in his perspective in the film. There's no apologizing for it, but it's fascinating.
And then locally, another great work, 4-part, 4-hour Save the Bay series.
Yeah.
That
good,
sounds
good
great.
Good work there, yes.
Thank you, Chris, for writing in. Let's go. Oh, Lee is writing in. Have you sat in a movie theater lately? As much as I would hate to see the end of movie theaters like The Shattuck, have you factored into this wonderful world of shared experience the chatter, the crinkle of the wrappers, popcorn chomping?
Well, look, first of all, someone mentioned that Roxy, one of your callers or writers, and I think it's a fantastic movie theater. They have beer now. They got a beer license. So, you know, as far as the Roxy's ability to attract a clientele, myself included, I think that's good. It's a start. Yeah, I mean, if people turn the phones off, I'm happy with that.
Yes, exactly.
And I'll live with some of the distractions. It's part of living in a society. There are times when, yes, it can be a bit much, but especially the smaller theaters, the indie theaters tend to have create a respect for the communal experience of watching a movie in the way that the more mainstream multiplexes might not so much.
Thank you for that. Give theaters one more try. Maybe
please
sit in the back or something away from people.
And unwrap your candies before the movie
exactly.
starts.
Art writes in, any comments on the National Lampoon documentary, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead?
Hilarious. I couldn't stop laughing. It's fantastic. I mean, is it a weighty documentary? No. Does that matter? No. I think there's room for all of these. And I sat there thinking, I can't believe all these people came out of that background. And similar in some ways to How to Change the World, here was this group and they were putting out this incredible publication, but they were such strong, intense and bizarre personalities that ultimately you know what's going to happen.
All right. Thank you for that one, Art. And then Julie writes, I've got to plug this amazing documentary. It's about a museum in Uzbekistan created by a man under the Soviets who was protecting all the, quote, degenerate art the Soviets didn't tolerate. Ben Kingsley, Sally Field, and Ed Asner narrated. It's so inspirational. I'd like to go there before it's too late. You can stream it online. It's called The Desert of or Desert of Forbidden Art, or Desert of Forbidden Art.
Sounds interesting.
Hmm. All right, thank you for that, Julie. Andy writes, one of the best documentaries I've ever seen is The Shadow of the Moon. It's simply, very simply, head and shoulder shots of the most of the surviving astronauts who went to the moon telling their stories, interspersed with original footage from the moon flights. Their tales are incredibly gripping. You're on the edge of your seat. It's simply these old guys telling their stories.
I grew up watching those launches, and I saw that movie. And, yep, I mean, I can't help it. I started to get a little weepy about the whole thing. But it's good, yeah.
Well, we've got just a couple minutes left. Any other films that you'd like to talk about?
Well,
Michael.
I'll throw one out, which is an Israeli film called Censored Voices that played the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival this past summer and opens January 8th. At the Opera Plaza in San Francisco, and hopefully the Shattuck, who knows, which revisits audio tapes, interviews that Amos Oz, who's now known as a very successful Israeli novelist, conducted immediately after the Six-Day War with soldiers who had just returned to their kibbutz. So we're talking literally weeks after the war. And it's revisionist history in the sense that this is history that was never told, in a way. For those of us who go back that far, the Six-Day War was a victory by underdogs. That's the popular story. Mm-hmm. The good guys won, blah, blah, blah. And it's amazing it's taken half a century, essentially, for these audio tapes to come out. I believe they were recorded and intended to be used at the time when the military banned them. Very, very little of that material was published. And the filmmaker has these soldiers who are, of course, now half a century older, listening to their tapes, listening to what they said then. And that part wasn't as effective for me, reading what was on their face. But he augments it with archival footage. And it's just a retelling of history that's it's shocking.
There's another film, Sherpa, which I think is spectacularly good. It's about the climbs of Everest, but it by and large took place. The documentary took place in the year where there was an avalanche that wiped out a lot of the Sherpas, and who then rose in protest to say this is unsafe and we're getting paid very little money, and catering to extremely rich people who are coming from around the world to climb. And it follows one Sherpa in particular. So it's a beautifully layered documentary with extraordinary cinematography. I've never seen anything quite like this, combined with a very strong social portrait of what the Sherpas are like at home and what the political movement that's becoming all the more powerful is among them for decent working conditions. a spectacular movie made for, by an Australian filmmaker. And then I think we mentioned before Winter on Fire about the Ukrainian Revolution. I think that's worth watching as well.
I just heard, it's talking about international documentaries. There was an interview with the filmmaker of Syria. So there's a new documentary about Syria, which I've been wanting to check out, just to throw that one out there. Another one I wanted to mention is Cowspiracy, which has done more to raise awareness about animal agriculture's effects on deforestation, water consumption, and pollution. It's responsible for more greenhouse gases than the transportation industry, and it's about why major environmental organizations won't talk about it. Really good. And Leonardo DiCaprio just directed the new version of it for Netflix.
Oh, good.
So it's on Netflix. And any others? We have two more minutes.
No, but there's this trend you mentioned of having celebrities present or participate in documentaries, primarily environmental documentaries. I forget the name of the film from 2 years ago that was about the hazards and perils of sugar that Katie Couric produced and narrated. Because Katie Couric will reach an audience that James Franco will not, let's say, or even that Leonardo DiCaprio may not. And I'm not decrying this in any way. I'm just saying there's an evolution in the environmental documentaries, an ongoing evolution. Documentaries are mainstream. Maybe that's really what we should be saying. They are mainstream, and they're not just bad medicine or even good medicine, as you'd put it, Dan, and entertaining, many of them, and featuring amazing characters, many of them, with experiences that you could not invent.
Well, that's it. The stranger than fiction aspect, I think, is always interesting to me. With stories that if you tried to adapt them into fiction films, you would look at it and say, no, that couldn't possibly happen. But when they're real and in front of your face, there's no denying it, and they're incredible stories that are out there. I mean, there's so many more list. I can't even.
Well, and I also just want to say thank you to you, Dan, and your wife, Dana, and all the other filmmakers out there, because we often forget people put their blood, sweat, and tears behind this, and sometimes they put it on their credit card.
Well, you have to be a little bit nuts to make an independent documentary, because there's no money. You know, it's a crazy endeavor, but it makes for a very rich life in terms of experiences.
Yes. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I want to see your film about the ballet.
Ballet Russe.
Ballet
sure.
Russe. Thank you.
And the Galapagos.
And the Galapagos Affair. Thanks.
Dan Geller and his wife, Dana Goldfein, have made documentaries for over 25 years, and Michael Fox is a longtime San Francisco film critic and journalist. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we're talking about the consequences of anti-abortion rhetoric and legislation. For weeks, heavily edited videos falsely implying Planned Parenthood profited from selling fetus tissue dominated headlines. When the organization was cleared of wrongdoing, there was little media coverage, and anti-choice rhetoric about body parts continued. The alleged shooter at the Colorado Springs Clinic mentioned body parts. How are anti-abortion laws and rhetoric affecting the safety of providers? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.